Welcome back to another episode of our brand new podcast, City Hall Pass, hosted by myself, the counsel to the mayor, Kapel Longani. We created this forum, the first of its kind in New York City, to provide you, the general public, with a unique window into the problem-solving process at the highest levels of our city government, and to be able to share insights into key decisions as told by the trailblazing leaders who made them. And now I want to introduce my two guest hosts today, two women who are truly brilliant and inspire me every day, Bess Chu and Kate Coughlin.
Thanks, Kapel. Happy to be here. This is Bess Chu. I'm currently Chief of Staff to the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
Hi, I'm Kate Coughlin, and I currently serve as Deputy Counsel for the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
And I'm really excited to tell you a bit about our guest today, the Mayor's top public health advisor, Dr. Jay Varma. Dr. Varma joined the Mayor's COVID-19 response team in April of this year, right in the thick of the pandemic. Before joining the administration, he most recently served as Senior Advisor to the Director of Africa CDC. He has also served in Southeast Asia, directing the U.S. CDC's programs and research, and in China, where he directed the U.S. CDC's International Emerging Infections Program. You'll hear more about this in the episode, but his current role was a homecoming for Dr. Varma, who served as the Deputy Commissioner for Disease Control at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene right here in New York City from 2011 to 2017. We hope you enjoy our conversation with the Mayor's Senior Advisor for Public Health, Dr. Jay Varma, who shared some fascinating insights into the COVID crisis from his unique perspective. Thanks so much for listening.
Okay, I'd like to welcome our next guest to City Hall Pass, Dr. Jay Varma, who has been appearing on TVs all across the country, and it's particularly New York City over the last 7 or 8 months, giving us terrific advice on how to keep ourselves safe during the COVID crisis. There's nobody who has more relevance to the city and what we're doing than Dr. Varma. So we very much appreciate Dr. Varma taking time to speak with us today. Jay, welcome to City Hall Pass. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Jay, when did you start?
I actually arrived in New York on April 4th and pretty much was working from the moment I arrived.
That's literally true.
Yeah, correct? That's literally true. Yeah. So what happened was I was actually, you know, I was in New York City for over 6 years before, from 2011 to 2017. I was the deputy at the New York City Health Department and so ran the public health lab and all of the infectious disease programs for the city. So I had a, you know, close connection, obviously, to New York and to public health in New York in specific. But most of my career I've spent living and working overseas and it felt sort of a strong pull to return. So at that For the past 3 years, I've actually been based in Africa, working specifically at the African Union in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, helping to build disease control programs for the continent of Africa.
And why did you decide to accept the job?
So really, it was a combination of personal and patriotic reasons. For some background, when all of this came to light, which is kind of the end of December, early January, when those of us in the public health world started hearing about this mysterious outbreak in China. I was based in Addis Ababa, and it was pretty much what I was working on from the moment I got back from my, you know, winter holiday in Ethiopia. You know, I had spent a lot of time in China. It was very clear to me that this was going to be an incredible threat to the health of the African continent, which was my focus at the time. And we were working pretty much nonstop from the second week in January to prepare Africa. Now, of course, I have close ties to the United States. Two of my children were studying based in the United States. And so as things got worse here in New York, I definitely felt a gravitational pull and concern to what was going on. From a personal perspective, to my two of my children, one who was in college, one who was in a boarding school, were displaced sometime, you know, during the second or third week of March because campuses were closing. In Ethiopia, my wife and my other daughter were there, and there was a move to get all non-essential Americans by the embassy out of Ethiopia. And on top of that, my daughter's school, she was in her senior year of school, was closing as well. So they had already made a plan to come back to New York, which is where we had envisioned sort of returning full time when we got done with Africa. And then at the same time, I started to, on the one hand, both feel this concern over what's going on in the U.S. You know, this is the type of thing I can help with. The second was, you know, I was getting questions from my colleagues who live in some of the poorest and most difficult places in Africa, literally every morning saying, Jay, what's going on in New York and in the U.S.? Why are things so bad right now? And so was also feeling a little bit of a frustration that I couldn't be there potentially to help. And then I ended up getting requests and had some communication with the city. And really, I guess to sum it up, it was really a personal and patriotic reason that I came back.
So Dr. Varma, as you may know, and for those that follow me on Twitter or in our newsletter or have seen the Council to the Mayor website, I have a golden doodle named Charlie that I love very much. And whenever we travel, if we can drive there, we usually try to bring her. So when you were flying back from Africa, I know you had to travel with some pets. How did that go?
Oh, yeah. I guess this is more painful than funny, which is that, you know, my wife and daughter had to really just pack up really abruptly to leave during kind of the second and third week in March, which left me with our house in Ethiopia. We have two cats that we actually adopted in China and kind of been with us all over the world. These were stray cats that were born out of a litter and in China, and my kids desperately wanted us to adopt them. So these two cats have been with us all over. So I was left at the house, our car, and everything else. But I had assumed I was staying in Africa and that I would be there for a couple of months and maybe get a chance to come back to the U.S. in the summer to see my family. But then obviously when all these events took place, I had to, within about a week, try to figure out how to sell our car, pack up as much as we could, and then worst of all, try to figure out how to get these two cats and myself and as much luggage as I could possibly carry back to the U.S. And ended up actually having to get the cats their vaccinations, their health checks. And then I wasn't able to even fly direct to New York because we couldn't arrange a flight that the cats could come on. So ended up flying to D.C., rented a car, and drove to New York with these cats. And what my wife and kids will continue to chide me to this day is I was so stressed and tired during that trip in the car that he didn't pay attention to the fact that one of our pieces of luggage actually had kind of fallen onto the cat carriers.
Oh, no.
So thankfully, they were totally fine and healthy, but they were all shriveled up in a corner. And the first thing that happened wasn't my kids hugging me, but was screaming at me, Daddy, what did you do to the cats? But thankfully, they are fine to this day.
So when you were, for example, in China, and then in December and January, you're in Africa and you're hearing about this possible outbreak. Did you reach out to the Chinese CDC? And what did they say?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So I did, in fact, you know, as soon as I heard about this, it was right around New Year's Eve when I sort of first started tracking the information, immediately my sort of spider sense tingled. And the reason was I actually, one of the biggest sites that I was working with China CDC on was actually in Hubei province, the capital of which is Wuhan, which everybody knows, working with them to build systems and laboratory ability to diagnose what we called at that time pneumonia of unknown etiology. So a lung infection where we don't really know what the cause is. And that's really the trigger that, oh my gosh, something has happened. Well, sure enough, this was detected through that system that I had worked with the Chinese government to develop, what we call surveillance for pneumonia of unknown etiology. And I could immediately tell, based on the way the cases were being reported, that this had almost certainly been going on for months. Because there is just, and it's not just because of China, it's because everywhere in the world, it takes a while for doctors and public health systems to realize, oh, actually, this is weird and this is aberrant and abnormal. So I did, in fact, try to email several of my colleagues in China who I continue to work with to this day on helping them, you know, formulate some of their research and things. Didn't get any responses. Now, most likely that was because they were extremely busy, but obviously there was a political overlay too. But one advantage I had was actually at the Africa CDC where I was working, we actually have a liaison from China CDC because the US is providing assistance there, the Chinese government wanted to, and he's a close colleague of mine. And so he was able to also give us information that really verified what I was worried about, that these initial cases were cases of people who had been referred from one hospital to the infectious disease hospital in Wuhan. So what they were reporting as a cluster is really just the tip of the iceberg. Because think about how many people don't actually go to the hospital, don't get referred to a referral hospital. So that was my first sense here that something was really dangerously wrong.
And when was that, Jay?
This is, you know, really, I got back to Ethiopia, I think around the 9th or 10th of January we had taken a holiday in the United States. So right around that time is when I was, you know, contacting colleagues and having these discussions with my colleagues from China CDC.
Relative to other professions, and I'll include mine, the medical profession, for the most part, is apolitical, you would agree, correct?
Yep.
And fairly collegial and cooperative throughout the world.
Yeah, in fact, actually, that's what the U.S. has always pushed, is the notion that when it comes to public health, we all breathe the same air, microorganisms don't carry passports, transparency is actually in everybody's mutual best interest.
Yeah, there was a recent article in the New York Times, I think, over the past week, where they talked about the head of the equivalent of the United States CDC. What do they call it in China?
It's China CDC. They, in fact, you know, in the early 2000s, basically took US CDC's organizational chart and its names and plopped it into China.
and the Times was reporting that the head of the China CDC, I think an individual by the name of Dr. Gao.
Yeah, George Gao. Yeah, I know him well. Yeah.
He apparently is very well known in the United States, someone that cooperates frequently with people like yourself. But at some point in the sort of February, March time period, he stopped returning phone calls. There wasn't as much collaboration coming from the Chinese CDC. Did you notice that as well with your personal contacts?
We did not in the same way. I would say, okay, so there's two types of contacts. There's the people that I knew at China CDC who hadn't really communicated back, but I just didn't follow up necessarily, just because I assumed that they were, one, extremely busy, and number two, there's clear political tensions, obviously geopolitically, between the US and China. But because we had a colleague from China CDC sitting with us in meetings all the time, we were able to get information that I think other people may not have necessarily had. I can't say that it necessarily was life-changing type information. It was verification of what we suspected, that this outbreak was actually pretty widespread, that there was a lot of death occurring in Wuhan that wasn't necessarily recorded because people were dying in their homes and things like that. So I think maybe at one level it helped us understand the severity of this, that maybe people in other parts of the world without having that information may not have understood.
Dr. Verma, you know, you've spoken a lot about your work in other countries and a little bit about your work in New York. Coming back from Africa and spending so much time abroad, you've kind of been embraced by the city of New York. And I know that our team talks to you a lot, you know, a bunch of lawyers talking to a bunch of doctors. Can you tell us a little bit about what the differences are between kind of your interactions here in New York compared to your interactions, you know, abroad? I know that, you know, you speak to our team a lot about things like gatherings and the public health issues related to it. And we are coming at it from a legal lens. Did you have those conversations when you were abroad?
Yeah, no, I think there's probably a couple of differences in the way my work is over there compared to what it is over here. And some of those are one of the reasons why I like working in New York and some of the reasons why it's challenging. So I would say, first of all, I mean, the same question, you're asking and trying to answer the same types of questions. You know, what do we know? What can we do with that information? And not just what the evidence is, but what are the trade-offs? What are the harms? What are the benefits? What is acceptable? What is feasible? And what are the, you know, how does this impact our values? And so science has the answers to some of those questions. Non-scientists have the answers to other parts of this question. So we still have those same debates. I think a lot of what the difference is for me is that the distance between me making that decision and actually impacting people's lives is very narrow or very short here in New York. You know, the decisions that we are making are directly impacting my friends and family and what we see on the streets. Whereas the work that I'm doing overseas is very distant than that. When I'm in China, you have a country of over a billion people, and I'm working with China CDC, and some of the provinces that we're working at, 50 to 100 million people. The work we do has an impact, but it can take quite a long time to see that impact and to know that you actually change things. Whereas here in New York, you know, you see the impact directly. Now, closely related to that, because the decisions have such immediate and direct consequences, you also have to have much more intensive debate. And so I do feel like, you know, the work we do here is, you know, it's much more rigorous. And that makes it challenging because I can't simply promulgate. I was writing guidance that covered the entire African continent about how to quarantine people when they come from overseas. But I'm not the one having all those immediate debates and trade-offs. And so we're doing that here. So to me, that both has tremendous value, you know, for me professionally, but it's also the challenge. It's a lot of work.
You mentioned earlier that in, you know, your current role in New York City, one of the things that you really like is that you have this direct, immediate impact. And actually, as we're sitting here now, you're waiting to sit in on the mayor's daily press conference. Have these press conferences been helpful in terms of communicating to the public, you know, various different health protocols?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, one of the other sort of skills and challenges that people in public health have needed to develop, and you can see how challenging it is right now, is the ability to communicate clearly and concisely, even though it is complex information where there is a lot of uncertainty around that information. And so I think these press conferences are important for a couple of different reasons. One, they obviously give us an opportunity as a city to highlight to people what are things that they should be concerned about and what are the things we are concerned about. And this is a problem that affects every single one of us in every part of our lives. And getting in front of people what we know and what we don't know and how we're going to find out is important every day. That's number one. Number two is, I think it helps us understand what are the questions that are arising. Our media and our press, they bring to light questions from a perspective we often haven't thought of, but clearly affect a certain percentage of the population. They keep us on our toes. They make us double check and triple check what we're doing. And I've actually always found that much as it's challenging in the US, actually one of the reasons that you don't actually have the same health systems that you need in other parts of the world is because you don't have a media that's actually asking questions and demanding better of government. So I think it helps us get our message out. It helps keep us in line and know and get a sense about what we should be thinking about, how we should be refining it. And the third, for me personally, it's a great opportunity to really practice how I can communicate, because you need to be able to communicate to different audiences. And having that kind of daily interaction is practice.
Hey there, and thanks for listening to City Hall Pass. I want to take a moment to remind New Yorkers to get tested for COVID-19. Testing is free at hundreds of locations across the city. To find a testing site near you, visit nyc.gov/COVID test, call 212-COVID-19, or text COVID-TEST to 85548. I also want to remind our listeners that this year's flu vaccine could be the most important one you ever get. The New York City Department of Health recommends that everyone 6 months and older receive a flu shot as soon as possible. To find a vaccination location near you, visit nyc.gov/flu. Thanks for listening.
As the pandemic has evolved, you know, public health experts, including yourself, have, you know, increased messaging on encouraging people to get testing, even if, you know, they're not feeling sick. I'm feeling fine today, personally. You know, why should I go get tested?
Yeah, I think one of the ways in which we really got, and by we, I'm referring to kind of the global public health, infectious disease, emergency response community, had trouble with early on, was not understanding that this virus could be transmitted by people who don't have symptoms. And not only can it be transmitted, it can actually be transmitted very effectively by people without symptoms. That is not common for many infectious diseases. It's much more common of a disease like measles, for which the only way to control it is through a vaccine. And so it wasn't really until maybe, I would say, probably the end of February and early March that we in the sort of global public health community really became to understand that not only is it transmitted by people without symptoms, but there's a lot of transmission from people without symptoms. And so that became very important because it changed a number of things. It absolutely led to us embracing the concept of wearing masks, because masks can actually prevent you from transmitting to other people. And we didn't know that until then. And so that's what led to the shift from, you don't really need to wear a mask if you're out and about in public, to saying, actually, everybody needs to wear one. And the second was, who do you test? Before, our guidance and what I was writing in Africa is that, well, we need to test people who have symptoms and people who are coming to healthcare facilities. And then immediately it said, actually, we can't just do that. We actually need to test a much broader swath of the population. So we now do recommend that people routinely go get tested, because there is the possibility that you could be infected and infect other people. And so we put out a much more blanket recommendation now about testing than we did early in the epidemic.
Following up on that point, I think people, the general public, and I'll include myself in this, often view science as a set of rules, right? And not as an evolving subject, right? Something that changes based on the data as it comes in. You just talked about face coverings, for example. I watched an interview last week of Dr. Fauci, and Dr. Fauci talked about how he's been criticized for initially saying face coverings were not needed, and then subsequently reversing course and saying actually they were needed. And his response to why that changed and how that affected the public's view of the government's credibility on this matter is that at the time he suggested that the public didn't need these masks, one, there was a shortage of these masks, and he felt the masks needed to go to first responders, doctors, nurses, et cetera. And secondly, there wasn't the data that we have now, which clearly shows even wearing a cloth over your mouth and nose has an effect, a very positive effect in controlling the transmission of COVID. Have you felt the same, like have you had members of the public, members of your own family come to you and ask you that same question? You were telling us one thing, now you're telling us something else. And if so, how do you respond to that question?
No, I think the issue of masks and the guidance that was given is going to be a really critical lesson for public health people for the future. And it hits on a number of different issues. And so I want to go through this because I do think they're really important for people to understand. First is a defense of public health. And then the second is a criticism of it. The defense is that, you know, the process of science is basically ask a question, generate the evidence, and change your views on that question based on the evidence itself. So when we're presented with new facts, we change our opinions to fit the facts. We don't change the facts to fit our opinions. And that is a basic tenet of science. And so we feel very comfortable changing our mind in this situation because there were things that we didn't know. We didn't know that you could transmit without symptoms. We didn't know that you could transmit and cause outbreaks, like lots of transmission without symptoms. And the third is we didn't know that people who wear these can both reduce the risk of transmitting to other people and be protected themselves, even if it's not a full medical grade mask. So those are three pieces of evidence that we didn't actually have and which justified our position. Now, that's the defense of public health. Here's the criticism of public health is, number one, we didn't communicate our uncertainty about that question enough. I personally sat in, I was the representative from the African Union, the Africa CDC to WHO, for the first global health meeting about coronavirus, the first global emergency response meeting in Geneva. Huge gathering, by the way, where I sat next to somebody who was coughing the whole time. So just to give people a sense of where things were in early February. And I came home to my wife and I said, I will bet you I already got it. And I didn't actually, but I don't think I did. But anyway, at that meeting, and we had discussions about this. And I actually myself, I think to my credit, and I'll say to my detriment, asked the question, well, don't we think it's still better than nothing? Like, what is the standard of evidence that we need? Do we need to use a standard of evidence that says we need certainty to do this? And the response I get was, well, what if wearing those masks is worse than nothing? What if people touch their face? What if it gets wet and people think that they're protected when they're not? What about the fact that we know that these things aren't 95% effective like our N95 respirator is? And I deferred to people who are experts and said, well, they really are the ones that study this in hospitals all the time. I think that they're right. That was a mistake. We didn't acknowledge and our uncertainty and respect the humility of the fact that we don't know. And then sometimes it's better to err on the side of better than nothing and not make assumptions about things that we don't know, like how people's behavior change. The other error that people made was introducing this issue of supply. And anytime you make a recommendation in public health based on resources, you better be prepared to explain why you aren't fixing that resource constraint. And I do fear and worry that a lot of our public health recommendations were tainted by not based on what is the right thing to do, but what is actually feasible based on our resources. We should have been clear, this is the right thing to do, but it's not feasible because of this, as opposed to combining those two into one message, which is what the public heard.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think as a follow-up to that, you know, because members of the public have been getting messaging both, you know, locally from public health officials, federally, from whatever they see on the news, you know, they're getting inconsistent messaging about should you wear a mask? Should you not wear a mask? Should you stay away from people? Is it 6 feet? Is it 10 feet? You know, is it safe to go into a store? And I think, you know, recently we've heard a lot more about people feeling something called COVID fatigue. You know, people are like, I'm tired of canceling my plans. I want to go on vacation. I want to go, you know, sit at a restaurant. What, if any, message do you want to share with the people who are, you know, tired of following all these restrictions?
I think the best thing to say is that we're all tired. This is not fun. There is this kind of weird straw man out there that says that public health people are all super disciplined and want people to bunker down in their homes forever. No, we don't. My wife and I like going dancing. We like having parties. We like traveling. My family has traveled all over the world. I was supposed to go back and see my family in India this winter with my kids. We're excited to go see their family there. And we can't do any of those things. I want to be back on a plane and traveling and doing these things. We all feel the same way. And so I think the first thing I would say is you're right to feel exhausted. And so that's the first thing. I empathize. The second is, I think for people to understand that we put out these guidance because we want people to do the best they possibly can. We don't expect perfection. Just do it in a way that is as cautious as you can. We don't live in a world of zero risk. We don't live in a world of zero exposure. And the scary thing is this virus is probably going to live with us and be in our world for a long time. Even a vaccine. We have vaccines against measles. We have them against the flu. They're not eliminated. So we have to be able to embrace the idea that there are things that we should just be weighing, risks and benefits, and how can we reduce those risks the most? And I do think that's true with the public. Like recognizing that we are all going through this fatigue, but also understanding that we're in this for the long haul helps people adjust. And I think pace themselves.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that even as a public health expert, at the end of the day, you're still a human being. And in spite of all the best practices, I think it's interesting to hear you articulate what a lot of New Yorkers are thinking. Hopefully things will change over time, but it's not fun for any of us.
No, I think, you know, I don't know how to do this collectively. I think and this is where public health is not the answer to the problem, but people need to be able to mourn their losses. And we have this problem in our family. I mean, we have a little family WhatsApp group and it's like victim Olympics sometimes. My kids are like fighting with each other. Just yesterday, there's like 100 messages between my two older girls fighting over who has it worse. My daughter who's losing her senior year at college versus my daughter who lost her senior year of high school and now her freshman year of college. And we need to give them space to say that it's horrible for both of you and for all of us and be able to mourn that, but also prepare ourselves and be grateful for the things we do have. We have been incredibly blessed. My family has gotten a chance to live and work all over the world. We are blessed with health. None of us has gotten this infection. We don't have any close family members that have suffered illness from this. We are financially stable. We have things that 99% of the people on this earth do not have. So we try to balance that with them. I can't say I do the best job. I think my wife is better than I am of listening and hearing and letting them mourn their losses while at the same time saying, be grateful, and we have to sort of suck it up.
Does your phone, when you leave City Hall, does your phone ring off the hook on a regular basis from your friends calling you to ask about advice related to how they should be living their life? And, oh my God, I just coughed. Do you think I have COVID? How often should I get tested? I get that a lot in terms of legal questions. People call me all the time about, well, isn't this illegal? Well, how can we do this? And, you know, these are non-lawyers, but I wonder if you encounter the same thing.
It's been pretty much endless since all of this started. I actually even had a little face group that I had started when I was in Africa just to answer questions from friends and saying, don't message me directly, just put it on this little thing so I can answer the same question to everybody. And and it happens all the time. And actually, the person that is most upset with me is my wife. My wife is a pediatrician and she has tons of COVID questions that she gets from her patients, from her partners, from other people that she needs some help answering. I think literally during this interview, I just saw that she messaged me another one. And she gets so upset because I'm just like tired of talking about this all the time. And I just like, and she's like, I'm sorry to ask you because I know you're getting this question. But yeah, this is coming up all the time. But it's like in my head, 24 hours a day, I just need some brain space sometimes. But yeah, I feel like we have to be able to help people. And so I do my best to help, but I also, to be quite honest, I've become more antisocial. A lot of my friends from college have like Zoom chats all the time. And one of the reasons I don't do them is because, well, first of all, I'm just tired of talking. And second of all, I'm tired of talking about this. So
yeah. Speaking of questions that are personal, since we have you here, I want to ask you about antibodies. So we've been hearing a lot, you know, about this antibodies test. One, is it worth it to get it? Two, if you have the antibodies, does that mean you won't get it again? And three, so my husband has had the antibodies twice and tested positive both times, but I've tested negative. And how is that possible that two people who live in a tiny New York City one-bedroom apartment?
Yeah, so lots of challenging questions. And I'll start with just a couple of, you know, important, big, broad comments for people to understand. One is, immunology, that is the way the body fights infections, is really complex. And we in medicine probably understand maybe 5% of it. Man, that may even be an overestimate. The second is, this is a new infection and we're learning all the time. And it turns out that every new virus even though it has relative viruses that cause the common cold that are also called coronaviruses, can behave and cause your body to react differently. So there's still a lot that we don't know. So starting with those premises, here are some things that we do know that tests for antibodies that you have, as long as they're done from a kind of reputable lab, which most of the labs, pretty much all the labs, obviously that we here for the city hire, but you know all of those, but pretty much any reliable antibody test does have a pretty good ability to say that you were infected with this virus at some point and that you probably have some level of protection. Okay, that's one. Number two is there are people who have been infected before that don't show any evidence of antibodies, either because they didn't develop that response by their body or their antibodies are no longer detectable in their blood. Because just because you were infected with something doesn't mean that you are protected forever and doesn't even mean that your protection is 100%. What we do know or have a pretty good confidence is that many people, we don't know if it's most, it may be most, but many people who have been infected with this virus develop some level of protection for a few months, probably about 3 months, that prevents them from getting reinfected. But after that time, they are at risk of getting infected again. There's so much that we don't know. We don't know, are they at high risk for, you know, how high is their risk of getting infected? If they get infected, are they partially protected? Do they get a very mild illness or no symptoms at all that time? So there's just a lot that we don't know. So I guess the briefest way to answer your question is we don't tell people that they should get antibody tested, but we make it widely available because a lot of people are interested and curious about it. One value it does have is it can help answer questions about uncertainty where you wonder whether you might have been infected or not. But of course, it may also then raise questions like, why does my husband have antibodies and I don't? But some people it helps give them a certainty that infection, that illness I had, that really was probably coronavirus. The third is it does have value in terms of donating for plasma. Plasma is basically, you know, part of your blood that can potentially help people who get infected if you can give them a plasma infusion. There's still some debate about that, but it probably is beneficial. So people who have antibodies are candidates for donating and benefiting others. And we really do encourage New Yorkers to donate blood and plasma because it can help for a number of conditions.
Dr. Varma, do you think, in spite of the fact that we don't have a vaccine yet for COVID, we do have a vaccine that is at least partially protective for the flu. Are you advising your friends, colleagues, and the general public to make sure that they get their flu shot this year?
Oh, absolutely. I got my flu shot beginning of September. So did all of my kids and my wife. We're huge. I won't say belief because it's not a belief. This is evidence. You don't believe in gravity. It just exists, whether you believe it or not. So flu vaccines work. They're not perfect. And not because they harm people, that I want to emphasize that they're incredibly safe. It's because they don't just cover all the strains and everybody's body doesn't react, but they do a huge amount for us as individuals and for our health system to keep people out of doctor's offices and potentially at risk of thinking that they might have COVID. So yes, please go get your flu shot. We encourage all New Yorkers from 6 months of age and on up to get one.
And, you know, so we're still learning a lot about COVID and, you know, the science is still developing. Where do you think we'll be a year from now?
Yeah. So what I have said for myself and my family, both to give us hope, but also hope informed by knowledge, is that sometime by the end of next summer, I think we will have some sense of normalcy. Okay. And I want to emphasize why I said some sense of normalcy and not normalcy. I do think there are certain things that are going to be hard to do. It's going to be hard for us to justify having, you know, large mass festival type concerts or something, or, you know, stadium arenas that are 100% full with people. But I do think we'll be able to do a lot of the things that we want to be able to do. And the reason I think that is what we have right now are three really blunt tools. We have things you can do as an individual: wear a mask, wash your hands, keep your distance. We have things that we in government can do with you: get you tested, follow up with you through testing and tracing, isolating, quarantine. And then we have things that government does to you, which is we keep bars closed, we limit restaurant hours, we limit gatherings. Those are not great tools. Those are just what we have available. What we will have hopefully available, and I'm pretty optimistic we have, is number one, we will have diagnostic tests that people can use in their homes, hopefully similar to like a pregnancy test or even like a thermometer. They may not be perfect, but they'll give you some idea and it'll let you kind of screen yourself. That'll free us up public policy-wise to allow people to do more activities, I think. And then we'll have a vaccine, which I can't be 100% confident that every vaccine that's developed is going to be perfect and work very well. But I am confident that at least one of them, if not more of them, will do reasonably well at controlling this. And when you combine all those things together, I do think what I've told my kids is I'm pretty sure they're going to be able to go to school next year and have it feel close to normal. They may still have to wear a mask. They may still have to be a little careful about things. But I don't think it's going to feel as aberrant as it does right now.
Fortunately, that means I'll have to go to my husband's family reunion next year. Yes. So I don't love that.
I want to thank Dr. Varma for spending some of his time today talking to us and continuing to educate the public. And I will say, having worked with Dr. Varma, he's the best of the best. And New York City is very lucky to have him and his expertise. And as a lawyer, I could say I am so thankful to have him around. It's just such a pleasure working with someone who not only cares so deeply about the public health of this community, but wants to make sure that everyone's rights are respected as well. And so on behalf of the city, Dr. Varma, thank you very much. And thank you for spending time with us today.
Great. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Well, that's the end of the episode. We want to thank Dr. Varma again for joining the pod and for providing New Yorkers with some crucial guidance as we continue to work through this crisis. The city is clearly in good hands with Dr. Varma's leadership and expertise. Thank you all for listening and stay tuned for more episodes. This podcast is brought to you by the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor of New York City with support from the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. Special thanks to our executive producer, Stathi, and a big thank you to Karen, Roland, and Andrew from the Mayor's Office of Media Entertainment. We couldn't do this without you.